Okay.
Hopefully we've got the technology working.
So welcome to the hearing for the ArcLab permanent rulemaking. There's a few different parts of tonight's meeting. We'll have a little bit of intro from me, and then we'll have a summary of the proposed rule from George Davis, the writer. And then we'll have a Q&A period after that. So if you have questions about the rule or about today's process, that would be a good time for that. And then at that point, we'll start kind of the more formal part of the hearing, and that's the public comment part. So if you have comments to give and you want those in the official record, that's the time to make those. You have some blue slips of paper in the back, so if you want to give a comment during the oral comment period, you can fill that out. That'll let us set up a system for taking turns, and also when we make the notes of the comments people gave, we'll be able to know which person said what. Let's see. So I wanted to give a little bit of introduction about the overall process. So this is a permanent rulemaking. There's a current temporary rule that was passed by the EQC in April. Temporary rules have less public notice requirements. Actually, they have very little. But they also can only last for 180 days. So this is a permanent rulemaking to replace that temporary rule. And we're going through the public notice process. The public comment period for this rule started June 15th, and it closes next Friday, July 29th at 5 p.m. So all the comments that are submitted writing during that time, DQ will consider and respond to those, and also all the comments that you give orally tonight will be considered in that same way. It doesn't matter whether they're in-person comments or written comments coming in to the website. What we'll do with those, so we will review all the comments that come in. We'll categorize the different ideas and comments that we received, and then we will write up a DEQ response for those. And so that response won't go to the individual person who gave the comment, but that response will be in a document that we then take to the Environmental Quality Commission, EQC, when we are proposing the rule for them to vote. So we will definitely consider your comments. We may or may not make changes to what we propose to EQC based on your comments. The plan is for the EQC to vote on this in either late September or early October. October 3rd is our current date that we need to shift to. That's the time when the EQC would make their final vote on whether to adopt the rules as we suggested or not adopt them or some other combination. Questions about the kind of rulemaking process?
Is there a process of adoption or also a public process?
It will be, yeah. So their EQC meeting is a public meeting, and anyone can attend. I think sometimes they take comment at the meetings as well. Is that quite right?
Occasionally they do. I don't expect they will this time since we're taking the comments now. It's also possible that the commission meeting will be held by phone, and so that will be a matter of dialing in. Although we may have a room set up here with a phone.
Kind of
depends. Yeah, if we do have a place set up, it would be here. And then, again, a number of the commissioners may dial in because they live all over the state. But there will be some way for public access if you want to hear what the commission does.
So in the
temporary to the permanent rulemaking process. Obviously, there's some timelines that are set forth for Tier 1 and Tier 2 manufacturers to come into compliance with, obviously, one, temporary rule, and two, now the permanent rule. If the EQC or DEQ does take an opportunity to change or modify the temporary rule, how does that help these manufacturers to come into compliance with the permanent rule? Because there's obviously time frames that sort of fall right in the same time as the permanent rule to the temporary rule, and, you know, obviously for Tier 1 manufacturers, there's some stuff that obviously we've all talked about. So how does that work? How does that work for manufacturers to come, you know, one, in compliance with the temporary rule in this time frame, and then also have to come into compliance with the permanent rule that is sort of lapsing over temporary rule?
And what I'd like to suggest that, and we did have a question and answer period.
Okay, yeah, I'm okay with that.
You don't mind waiting?
Yeah, no, I don't mind at all.
You may have to re-ask your question.
That's totally fine. I know Joe just asked the question about questions about the process, so that was sort of,
okay.
Nope, that's fine.
Yeah, maybe it's a good time to go ahead and shift gears, and George, you can give a summary of what DEQ is proposing or what the Republic is.
Yeah, I can do that unless you don't think it's necessary. You've all become familiar with the temporary rules. I'll go ahead and start, and if you want me to shut up, say something. So, good evening, everyone. Just a few introductory remarks, about a page and a half worth, and then we'll begin the question and answer period. So, as Joe said, in April of this year, the EQC adopted the temporary rule for regulation of color guard class manufacturers, and that was done to address the elevated metals levels that, that were monitored in Southeast Portland. And Joe already talked about the rules being in effect for 6 months and about the difference between, another difference between temporary rules and permanent rules, of course, is that for the permanent rules, we do have to have a public process. And this is part of that public process. So the rules have been on notice since the end of June. We're holding a hearing tonight to take your comments verbally if you want to comment tonight. And you can also submit written comments up until 5 p.m. Friday, July 29th. And if you need information on how to submit a written comment, there's information on the table in the back of the room. So the proposed permanent rules are the same as the temporary rules. However, the rules can be revised, and that's part of the reason for taking your comments is to review your comments in view of the rules and perhaps make changes. To briefly describe the major elements of the temporary color guard glass rules, they apply to facilities that manufacture color guard glass, provided the facility manufactures 10 tons per year of color guard glass or more, and is located in the Portland Air Quality Management Area, which is basically the greater Portland area. The smaller manufacturers are classified as Tier 1. The larger are classified as Tier 2. And in addition to the size differences, the Tier 1 facilities use electricity to heat their glass, while the Tier 2 facilities use natural gas. There are two or possibly three Tier 1 facilities and two Tier 3 facilities. Beginning on September 1st of this year, the larger Tier 2 facilities may not use raw materials containing arsenic, cadmium, chromium, lead, manganese, or nickel, except in glass-making furnaces that are equipped with an emission control device that meets the requirements of the rules. And there are other metal usage restrictions for the Tier 2 facilities. The smaller Tier 1 facilities have three options, which have to be met by October 1st. Option one is to install an emission control device that meets the requirements of the rules and to only use raw materials containing those six metals, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, lead, manganese, and nickel, in furnaces that use the emission control device. Option two is to perform emissions testing and dispersion modeling to show that their emissions have ambient impacts that are less than levels specified in the rules. And option three is to request permit limits to prohibit the use of one or more of the metals. And at this point in time, we understand pretty much everyone is moving toward installing emission controls. Finally, the rules include a requirement for both Tier 1 and Tier 2 facilities to test the emission control system and show that it has a particulate matter removal efficiency of 99% or more.
there are different types of emission control devices that can meet this requirement that most of the manufacturers intend to install tag houses. Again, for the proposed rules, we did not propose any changes from the original temporary rules, but we did request input on certain other options. And the options that we requested input on are these. First, should the rules be modified to apply to sources that make less than 10 tons per year of colored art glass? And if so, what threshold would be appropriate? Second one is, should the rule be modified to apply statewide rather than just in the Portland area? And finally, the temporary rule requires that control devices be tested to show that they capture at least 99% of the particulate matter. We have received indications that for some facilities, capturing enough particulate matter during the test may require an unmanageably long source test, unmanageably long and very expensive source test. So the question is, should the 99% capture efficiency standard be replaced with some other requirement? And that's the end of my introductory remarks, and we'll now open it for questions and answers. You try to get to Abe's question first.
Yeah. Do you want me to go over that question? I know you guys have heard this from me before, obviously, just the lapse in time. Obviously, like you just said, tier one manufacturers need to be in compliance with the temporary rule come October 1st. Obviously, have an application in for our permit as well. Our biggest concern, and I know all you guys know this, is the 99% efficiency. We have investigated this with environmental consultants, testing companies that test air. Most of them are saying that they don't feel that our companies, you know, mainly tier one manufacturers, do not have enough particulate matter coming out of our stacks that they can get an accurate test in a short period of time. Where obviously we've already seen that Bullseye within, it looked like a 16-hour test that they've done shows the efficiency of the 99%. We've had multiple quotes for this ranging anywhere from $100,000 to $350,000. We are the small little guys here, and how are we, how are we going to come into compliance with that if for some reason a modification to the temporary rule isn't changed?
Can I step in for just 1 second? I want to make sure that our audio is working in case there's someone out there.
Yeah.
Maybe I can ask Jacqueline or Keith, could you be willing to dial in from your cell phone and just make sure that the audio is okay?
Sure.
Sorry for that interruption there.
No, you're fine.
So while Joe is doing that, part of that, We understand completely the problem that
yep.
creates for you, Abe, and for the other Tier 1 manufacturers. It's a little difficult to answer the question. In fact, it's very difficult to answer the question, particularly until the Environmental Quality Commission acts on its rule. And in a sense, it all comes down to a question of time.
Yeah.
Because the rules give you a certain amount of time after your equipment becomes operational to perform the test. And I guess what we can't predict what the commission is finally going to adopt.
Yep.
And tonight we can't speculate on what DEQ's proposal to the commission might be after the end of this public comment period. But we're acutely aware of the problem, and we do want to work with you to make sure you don't end up running afoul of the rules, and also that you're able to get the equipment operating as soon as you can.
Yeah, and I think that's another problem for us as well. We're pretty much ready. We're very close to turning our baghouse on, and obviously there's parts of the temporary rule that scare us because. Mm-hmm. You know, following the rule setting, it could show that North Star actually gets a violation of the rule, and that is a big concern to us. And you know, obviously looking to DEQ, you know, that proposed these rules to the EQC that passed, you know, there is a fault there, in my opinion. Every air sampling company as well said they will not guarantee the test. Also, that's also something that you know, let's say we had the money to spend $350,000 on this test, and it fails. That puts, I mean, it's almost to the point if we had to do that, Northstar would be out of business. And I just really want to reiterate that to DEQ. Obviously, we're going to send in some letters as well to the EQC, explaining to them sort of this what we're seeing as well. So hopefully there's something. Does DEQ have any options for, let's say, the Tier 1 manufacturers at this minute? How can we come into compliance with this temporary rule?
The tough answer is that we don't have options at this point. We do want to, you know, work with you again. Like I said, it might become a timing question more than anything else.
And I think the public would love to see us turn our bag house on immediately, right?
Right.
But, you know, as we're looking at it, we're sitting here going, well, we might as well just wait, you know, so that we don't get caught red-handed. And it's a bummer that that's the way it is, because we're ready to turn it on.
Like I said, we hear you a lot.
And I know.
We agree that it, you know, it is a problem. And it's just kind of a, for us, it's a problem. You know, we don't have the ability to make that kind of change.
I understand that.
And it has to go through this process with the commission. And I know that puts you in a bind. We're trying to figure everything out that we possibly can to make it work. So the only answer I can give you is kind of a lame one, to be honest. And that is just submit comment.
Right.
And, you know, on the record, either verbally or in writing, and express your concerns.
And so let's say we found out a way to do the test, right? And we go ahead and do the test in the time. Now, again, we're still waiting for the permanent rules to come into place that could trump that source test. So it's almost like we're damned if we're due and we're damned if we don't. And obviously, you know, this is giving us an opportunity to really go, you know, on the record here of, you know, our concerns with this temporary rule. You know, there's no other issues we have with the temporary rule at all except for that test.
Right.
You know, Northstar has stepped up and we've, you know, put our money where our mouth is, and we're ready, and we need something, you know.
We hear you.
And I know. I mean, I've obviously talked to you, George, Keith, and everybody in the whole system to, you know, voice our concerns here. And, you know, I do appreciate you at least being candid about what we're dealing with here. Okay.
Yeah. All I can promise is we'll keep trying to make it work out.
Okay.
Because we appreciate that you're moving forward to comply with the rule, intended.
Yep.
And that the test requirement does with the smaller facilities in particular in a real mind.
Yeah, I mean, it almost looks like it's going to cost the smaller facilities more money than it's going to cost Bullseye or Euroboros to even, by the time the bag house is set up and installed and we're, you know, producing 80,000 pounds of colored glass a year, when at least looking at the other numbers, you're talking 6 to 7 million pounds a year. This is a huge difference. These costs that we're incurring with just the testing part is, it could be detrimental to our company.
Yeah. And we never intended for that outcome. It was a technical error on the part of the rule writer.
Yeah. And I get it. You know, I mean, I know that, you know, the way the process started here was a tough one for everyone. And, you know, timing was a big thing for the public and DEQ as well. So I do appreciate you answering that question as best as you could, George. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I'm going to be extremely brief. I'm not nearly as heavily invested as what you guys have been. But the naive question is, if it's too small to measure, is it too small to be as excited about?
That's a good question. At this point, we really don't know. One of the driving considerations when the rule was originally adopted was to be very protective,
mm-hmm.
and someone may argue that we were overly protective, but we went too far. Unfortunately, we had to move immediately to do something, and
we're looking at the permanent rules. If you can't measure the darn thing, it's probably not hurting anyone, at least to the degree that living in this world otherwise might be.
Any technical information you've got?
I'm the voice of being like, but I'll do it briefly.
I guess to measure the 99% reduction, it means that the inlet has to be 100 times the detection limit. So it's detectable, but it has to be 100 times that in order for that test to be valid. So, that's the issue we're talking about.
So you mentioned two tier ones and two tier twos within Multnomah County?
Not necessarily Multnomah County, but in the greater Portland area.
The greater Portland area, is that include Washington County?
Yes.
So the boundaries are Multnomah and Washington County?
It's actually an area defined in our rules called the Portland area.
Okay.
And it includes Hillsborough, Beaverton, Coast, south down to about Tualatin, Wilsonville area, and then across to Gresham and the north of the river. So it's not exactly along county line. In fact, it's a fairly oddly defined area.
And within that geographical area, you identify four manufacturers, two tier two, two tier one?
Well, there are five, but one of them may be small enough that they actually fall out of the rules.
So who are the five and how do they relate to, and is one of them Owens Brockway or General Glass?
Neither Owens Brockway nor General Glass fall into the category because they don't manufacture the colored art glass. So the rule is pretty specific to that manufacturing sector. The five facilities are Bullseye Glass, Uroboros, North Star, Troutman Art Glass, and
Glass Alchemy.
Thank you.
This might piggyback on what Abe and you were talking about. You said there were three questions put before us today about the rules, and one of them was about the possibility of changing the test method. What are the other options?
A couple of options may be possible. One would be to change the 99% capture efficiency and replace it with, for example, what we call a grain loading standard. It's a measurement of the concentration in the outlet of the control device. That's one possibility. Another possibility is to use a limit that's based on pounds of emissions per ton of glass produced. If you've been involved in this process, you've probably heard about EPA's glass rule. That's part of success. It's based on a pound per ton criteria there.
Pounds
of particulate per ton of glass produced. So, there are at least two possibilities, and if anybody else has ideas, you can look.
So it's just those two?
So far.
Okay. And what did you call that? You had a fancy grain what?
Grain loading.
It's actually hey, Catherine. There's a list to it actually on the three bullet points on the.
Okay, thank you.
Just a little reference to it.
Okay,
sir. Hi, I'm James. I'm the general manager of North Star Glassworks, and I've been doing this for 17 years. And if I can just make a comment on those two options to stand.
So would be better. For your comment to officially count, it would be better to wait just a little bit until we start the official.
Oh, okay, all right.
This is kind of free for all question and answer.
Sure.
Although it's being recorded, these aren't officially on record.
Oh, that's okay. I'm just sharing.
Okay.
After looking at these test methods, testing what comes out of our ventilation seems to be make the most sense. If we look at what we're capturing with the 99%, if I'm mistaken, please do correct me, but in that situation, we're testing what comes into our hoods and what comes out of our ventilation system, correct? So these hoods are very powerful. We draw in a lot of air. We're next to a railroad. or next to two other companies, a plating manufacturer, several metal manufacturers. And we have a lot of trucks, diesel trucks, delivering stuff. All this stuff comes into our buildings. So I see somewhat of a discrepancy there in that method of testing, and what's coming in and then what comes out. Just as a, I don't think also on the other end, looking at how much materials per ton is produced doesn't really make sense either, because you could be making all cadmium glasses, or you can be making all cobalt. You know, it doesn't, you know, that method of testing doesn't give any weight to that. So what seems to me to be the most reasonable answer is to test what's coming out of our ventilation system, and if the machine is working properly. That's it.
And effectively, that's the aim of the test requirement, is basically to verify that the equipment is working properly.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, to be perfectly honest, bag houses and particularly equipment is extremely reliable, extremely effective.
Yeah.
We know that, and that's part of our thinking here, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, the difficulty is getting enough material during the test to get a valid test result. If you get too little, then you can't reliably attach a number to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys get that.
Yeah,
and as somebody that cares about the environment, I don't want to wait until it's proven that we're damaging the environment. I want to be proactive in what we're doing. You know, I care about my city. So let's find the way and move forward and start with it, you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Like I said.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. Thank you for your questions and your comments.
We will. We will.
This might be a really big question. I don't know. Maybe you can give a 25-second version. But what is the relationship between the cleaner air organ overhaul and the temporary rule? What will happen when the new air toxics regulation goes into effect, whenever that is at the end of next year, I guess, to this little tiny piece of it?
Well, so basically there are two possibilities, and we are not really able to speculate on which of the two possibilities it would be. But one possibility is that new rule, the risk-based air toxics program, will simply make this rule redundant, and it could then be just taken off the books. On the other hand, we may find at that time that we prefer to keep it on the books, that it's doing what we wanted it to do, so it could stay on the books. And at this point, we have no idea. But those are the two possibilities.
Thank you.
Would it be in DEQ's interest at all to allow for that as well, like Catherine's question was, would it be DEQ have that idea of saying, hey, why don't we postpone part of the permanent rules for the glass manufacturers until that other, you know, part is sort of put together so it doesn't seem sort of really redundant, I guess. Not to say that anyone's going to get away with something. I mean, like you said, every manufacturer in the setting is installing pollution control devices, no matter if it's on the furnaces that melt the metal HEPs that are in question or not. Would it be something that DEQ would have an interest in allowing that so that both of those rules sort of mesh together instead of one trumping the other or vice versa?
I understand what you're saying. I think the reality is that there's an expectation that we'll continue this rule. It was originally adopted to address a problem.
Right.
Suddenly drop it would probably not make much sense.
There'd be hell to pay on that one.
I understand what you're saying, but it is kind of an evolutionary process. We've taken the first step with this rule,
yeah,
and it may evolve out, and it may end up staying. But
Right.
We're kind of committed to this path.
Okay. Okay.
Any other questions right now? Or? I have a couple of questions. One of them is about the process. It sounded like what White said earlier, that the EQ staff doesn't have the ability to change the temporary rules at this point. They can only make suggestions. Is that correct?
It's a little more than that. We do not have the authority at DEQ to adopt or change rules, period. That authority is solely vested in the Environmental Quality Commission. So they're basically our governing board. So we're going to take your comments tonight and through the rest of the comment period. We'll analyze them. If we believe changes to the rules should be made, we will propose those changes to the commission, and they make them. The second question is unrelated. In the public comment that's already posted on the web, there was someone who claims that even after the two-tier two manufacturers were effectively shut down in terms of their emissions of metal halides, that their quality numbers didn't appreciably change. Do you have any information about that? Is that true?
I don't think it's true. All of the metals information, all the monitoring information is posted on our website, so you can look at it. So the earlier monitoring, which is in October and then earlier this year, like February, March timeframe, and all the monitoring was near Bullseye Management at that time. So when Bullseye stopped using cadmium and arsenic, the numbers dropped pretty significantly. Now, one of the things that's happening is we're still seeing chrome levels that are a little higher than expected, to be honest. And we don't really have a good answer for why that's happening. But they're not like the levels that we've seen earlier.
I have a third question to follow up with that.
So there's a huge section in the temporary rules that has to do with the chromium and testing for chromium and how to set the levels and, you know, all that stuff. So, and I know there were issues with the test, and so what is the fate of that whole section now regarding chromium in the rules?
The entire rule is open for comment. If we receive comments on that part of the rule, then we will review it and see if, you know, if we agree that some changes need to be made. If we receive no comments, then it may be, if we ourselves don't come up with, you know, valid reasons for changing it, then it may be just an evident change. So it's possible it will change, but it's also possible that it works exactly as we're. But we did not. We haven't proposed any changes.
Interesting. So one of the things I hear you saying is that the comments should be very specific. Yes.
If there's an element of the rule, citing the exact rule number and all that stuff is very helpful.
Thank you. Along that note, so this whole issue really came to the forefront with the new incidental MOS test, and then there were some questions about, because it's a relatively new test, what does it actually mean, because it's testing in a different manner than what's been established before. Is that progressing?
Yeah.
This conference is being recorded. Only the main conference is recorded.
That work is continuing. The MOS data is regarded as an indicator. It's not considered proof, but if MOS samples are analyzed and they do show high levels, that suggests that GDEQ needs to take our air and do actual air monitoring to either verify or disprove that there's something of concern. But the work is continuing. Using the MOS as an indicator. Yes.
But there is also ongoing air monitoring.
Right.
that's the data that we know is directly comparable to health level.
Okay. So the MOS kind of jump started, but then it slipped partially into a more standard tier with other monitoring?
I think the MOS triggered you to then set up the more expensive monitors that can take out, scientific comparable results.
Okay.
And someone is closing that loop. It's kind of a research project in a sense.
Yeah.
Where MOS is an indicator that maybe there's a problem here, and then we'll air monitoring. If it verifies it, then that kind of feeds back and says, yes, the MOS is a good indicator. And that's a conclusion that's probably years to come to, that it is a good, valid indicator. So far, we're using it to kind of point to where we should install monitors.
I just want to add to that I just read somewhere that in the eastern part of the state, which is a lot drier and doesn't have the kind of moss that we have, they're starting to work with lichens as a possible bioindicator of air quality.
Yeah, from a strictly scientific point of view, it's pretty interesting stuff.
But do they have to monitor maybe the Bronx Foundry, St. Joseph?
Yeah, it's not quite intense.
The air monitors that are, DEQ, I'm guessing, right, DEQ is the one that's actually installing the air monitoring. Are they around all the tier manufacturers at all? I know there's been a lot of talk about the ones near Bullseye and potentially Euroboros. Is there air monitors around, let's say, Glass Alchemy, Northstar, Troutman Art Glass?
No. They're around Bullseye, they're around Euroboros. Some of them deployed in other areas, some other work. I'll take that back. There is some work related to the MOS study in Glass Alchemy, maybe kind of in that area.
Yep.
But it's not specifically targeted at Glass Alchemy just because of the MOS
study. Yeah. And so has DEQ identified the air, obviously, like you've said, when Bullseye stopped using the metal HEPs in question, is that a real indication that Bullseye was, in essence, the person contributing to that? Or, obviously, like you've said, there's question about some high levels of hex chrome still in the air. I guess that's just a question, right?
High is relative. When Bullseye stopped using chrome, the chrome levels dropped pretty significantly, but they didn't drop down all the way as far as we thought, which suggests that there are other sources of chrome, chrome 3 and chrome 6.
Right.
And so when we talk about high, we're talking about high relative to the benchmark concentration that we use, but it's low compared to what we were seeing before.
Right.
So we take that as a pretty strong indicator.
Okay.
It's more than coincidental.
Right. Okay.
So we're only supposed to go to about a quarter till for the Q&A and then move into actually taking comments on the record. But we kind of want to leave it up to you, too. If you'd rather keep the Q&A going, you can...
Can I ask one more question? So when DEQ proposed this... rule to the EQC, why did DEQ only look at the Portland surrounding area? Why was this not focused on any other type of glass manufacturer that could have been, let's say, in Southern Oregon that just no one knows about that's making optical glass that might contain some of these metal HEPs in there that maybe we don't know about or DEQ hasn't found out or the EPA doesn't know as well?
I think there are a couple of answers. First, the effort was focused in the area where we knew we were having high metals levels. We didn't have any information in any monitoring to suggest other areas were affected. Secondly, there was an effort made to try to locate other glass manufacturers, and I was not personally involved in that effort, but as I understand, there really weren't any others that that we identified that are in the same categories as the five here. So to kind of, you know, keep it focused and not cause effects that we didn't want to cause. But yeah, obviously you've seen the problem with that.
Yeah.
unintended side effects of writing rules, kind of didn't want to extend the possibility to the entire state.
Do you think that would be sort of almost negligent on DEQ's fault when these rules are really supposed to be health, you know, based rules? While, you know, like I said, you might not have found somebody that's out there that might be a large polluter as well, or maybe has stuff in the air that's over, you know, their benchmarks in that area.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. We are, you know, first we're moving forward with the Greater Oregon rules to develop a broader air toxics program. And going from having nothing effectively to, you know, possibly a very complex and very comprehensive program. And it is a process of getting from zero to whatever speed that
is.
And in the meantime, yes, that means that we are... Things that are going to be regulated in the future aren't regulated at this moment, and so we are possibly missing something. But the other side of it, I think, is if we did find a significant problem, again, like kind of like we found in Southeast Portland, I think DEQ would react.
And so like, let's say North Star, right? Let's say we just want to get around the rule. We move to Eugene.
For the time being.
Right.
We'll catch up with you at the end of the
I'm sure of that. I'm just trying to, like, really put it out there as,
no.
you know,
yeah.
you know, if we're looking at health-based standards, this is really, you know, DEQ's responsibility to, especially, obviously, I'm going to comment on the three bullet points here when you guys allow the comments to happen, but I really do feel on, you know, our end and everyone else's end, you know, that should be in there, you know, and just a, you know, I do.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, George.
So, one last question?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. This gentleman here, I mentioned two other glass manufacturers in the area, and you said that they fell outside of the focus area, but that focus area is very, very tightly focused on architectural art and decorative glasses. Only do those two manufacturers make colored glasses.
The only one I'm familiar with is Owens Corning, and that's the plant over by 205.
Glass and Owens Rockway?
Yes. Did I say Owens Corning? Sorry, did
I? No, Owens, yeah, I get confused too. Owens Rockway.
And I'm not familiar with General Glass, but Owens Rockway. Glass containers, and it's been many years since I was actually with the permit writer, and they don't use any of the half kinds. So they make, you know, beer bottles, which are green and brown. But
they put out 250 pounds of lead annually, according to the EPA, and General Glass has a massive cloud of arsenic, similar to the Bullseye Glass, maybe a little smaller. So they show up as being major metals users.
And that's based on EPA's?
So the EPA found that Owens Rockley puts out 250 pounds of lead annually. And then General Glass and the Moss study, they sit right on top of one of the biggest arsenic hotspots in the city.
Okay. They are, although they are not addressed by this rule, not that they are unregulated, they're governed by General Glass. And all ones, Rockway is on a Title V permit, they as well as we know, when the larger rulemaking comes into effect at the end of next year, hopefully, they will probably be looked at. But at this moment, I don't know anything about General Glass. They don't use the perhaps they use arsenic, which is kind of interesting. Owens Rockway doesn't.
Yeah, I think Owens Rockway is a one-trick pony with the lead, but I believe that General Glass may also use cadmium, because I believe they also show up
as the cadmium hotspot, but I'm not sure about that. I know the arsenic, I have the arsenic map with me, and I was just looking at it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the biggest hotspots in the city for arsenic.
I'm surprised that someone
made anything here about it. Yeah. I was reading that.
Yeah.
If you get the iron
right. A lot of their plant is recycled glass as well. Is it, right?
Recycled glass.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
But now in this temporary rulemaking, you're specifically targeting all glasses that have colorants in them as raw materials. They can't be considered recycled in this rulemaking. I'm going to address that in my comments.
It'd be color.
Well, we do address color.
It's only if it's not colored.
No, any color.
That's not what the rulemaking says.
It's
dependent
on the words.
There's a...
That was the red flag for me.
Yeah. Well, go ahead and comment on it.
I will.
The rule specifically identifies color as not being a raw material. And that would apply
right
to
manufacturers.
Right. You can call that.
Hand it over to Joe and get out of the way here.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, George.
All right. Sounds like a good time to shift gears now and move to the more formal process of second year public comment. So comments you make now will ask for a couple things. So if you can state your name and your affiliation if you have one. That way we can credit those comments when we document them later. So we won't be responding directly to your comments as we say them. Like, our purpose now is to collect those, and then later on in writing in our package to send to the UCC, we'll be categorizing and responding to the ideas that you present. So I think a few of you have already submitted the blue slip of paper we have. Are there any more of you that would like to do a comment if you haven't yet done that? Okay. So I was thinking I would just shuffle these and then look like we've got five of you and we can add you up one at a time. James? If not, would you like to be the first?
Sure.
So if you want to be in the seat, you
can go.
Yeah.
So I was just going to address the options.
So if you would be the say your name and show your affiliation first, and then jump in.
Yeah, my name is James Hunt, General Manager. To address the first option, I think that all glass manufacturers should follow guidelines. Should be a limit as far as weight, because that's not really taking into consideration, I think, public health concerns. In terms of cadmium glass a year, and if that's your goal, you're still meeting. But you're not considering your neighbors. So I think that there shouldn't be a weight limit to this process. I do not have a comment on what that threshold should be. I just think that you're in the place you should be aware of compared to ammo. Again, I think that the rules for the, to address the second option, that these rules should not only apply statewide but nationwide. The responsible person business, I understand what damage we can have if the environment is not regulated. And I'd be limited by imaginary lines. To address the third option, as to change the 99% requirement instead of testing. I do think there are better other methods, primarily amongst them, in grain loading method, which in common terms would be measuring our ventilation and testing what's coming out of it to determine if we are polluting. I think that if we're looking at the 99% requirement, speaking with Corey Davis earlier, if I understand this correctly, we would have sensors inside our hood and the environment we are in, we're next to a train yard, we're next to a plating company, we're next to two metal fab shops, which have been noted for EPA violations. And all of these things come into our ventilation system will be collected under that requirement. And I think we should only be responsible for what's coming out of our ventilation system and proper testing, should that happen. As well, of course, as all regulations to make sure that the machine is running correctly.
One point of clarification I want to make. So we did call out those three specific areas to request comments, but you're able to comment on any part of the rule. So your comments don't have to be confined to those three.
Okay. I'm a little back then.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
Okay. Next up, Abe.
Woo!
Party time.
Hello, everybody. Abe Fleischman, the owner of North Star Glassworks. I want to comment on the request for other options. I think this is something we talked about earlier. Should the rule be modified to apply to sources that make less than 10 tons per year? I believe that is a yes on our opinion. We feel that any glass manufacturer that could be using any of the metal halves in question should fall under the same exact rule, no matter if it's 1 pound or 500 pounds. You've got to imagine that if, let's say for North Star, if we wanted to sort of skirt around this rule, we could set up garage shops all over the state here and produce small amounts of colored glass and garage shops all over the place and potentially pollute a small part of a local environment, no matter if it's your neighbors or whoever. So I definitely think that the rule should apply to any type of glass manufacturer that is using the metal halves in question. I will go down to the next section. Should the rule be modified to apply statewide? I believe that is a yes. Just like we spoke earlier in the question and answer period, that any manufacturer could be doing something right now that maybe DEQ doesn't even know about. I think the rule should apply statewide, and just like James Knox, my general manager, said, throughout the whole United States. Obviously there's problems with regulatory rules and laws, and as time goes by, these are great things to protect the environment. So, next one, temporary rule, requires all the Tier 1, Tier 2 manufacturers to test a 99% efficiency, testing the inlet and outlet of your pollution control device. There's obviously other options in the temporary rule that it seems that none of the manufacturers are going at those options. Everybody is installing pollution control devices. I think DEQ should really be concerned, and the public should be concerned about what is actually coming out of the baghouse. So testing actually the air that's coming right out of the baghouse. And following, I do like the recommendation that DEQ put here for the grains per day standard cubic foot of air. I think that test is actually a test that is easy for everyone to acquire without a really high financial impact to our businesses. North Star Glassworks has had quotes for these types of standard tests through the temporary rule that are in excess of roughly $350,000. We are a small manufacturer. I'm not going to say exactly how much we do in sales a year, but we had to pay for that test to be able to put us out of business. We are very conscious about the environment. We've been ahead of the temporary rule, I think, more than anybody out there. Our baghouse is ready to be installed. We hope that DEQ really takes that into consideration and make the change to the temporary rules to propose to the EQC a manner that is, one, protecting the public, and two, looking at the actual cost to these small manufacturers so that it doesn't put us out of business. There's one part of the temporary rule that I also do not agree with. Cadmium was one thing for the Tier 1 manufacturers that was noted as we can use it. It seems like most of all the Tier 1 manufacturers that are the smaller businesses all voluntarily stopped using cadmium just because of the public sort of outcry. And I do think that EQ should reconsider adding cadmium to that list as well. If you know anything about glass or the scientific chemistry of glass, cadmium volatilizes in most glass bodies as anywhere from 65 to 85% volatilization rate. And so that really means that any manufacturer that might be using 100 pounds of cadmium in a melter throughout the time, 65 to 70 to 85 pounds of that is actually going out of your stack. There's scientific data to back that up as well. There's books, there's studies that have been done on that. I think DEQ should take that into consideration while the rulemaking process is happening. And that is it for me.
Thank you.
Up next, Craig Forget.
My name is Greg Bourget. I'm the executive director of Portland Clean Air. It's our third year working on this issue. And, we're still pretty unhappy. The Environmental Protection Agency found that Portland ranked the worst city in the country for respiratory risk. When it came to cancer risk, there's a lack of data. So when it comes to diesel particulate, we ranked 32nd worst out of about 3,200 counties nationwide. Because in California, they require filters on these trucks, but they don't in Oregon. When it comes to other hazardous air pollutants, we have no real numbers for that because the DEQ doesn't collect them. The EPA is modeling to guess at these numbers. We rank pretty badly in the modeling as well. So starting 3 years ago, I started talking to people in Portland about air pollution, and I found that about 15% of people had heard of air pollution. It wasn't widely known that we have a problem here. But starting about 5 months ago, that went to about 98% of the population realizing that we get a serious problem. So I myself talked to about 1,200 people, and about 700 of them have joined our group. So now we have about 1,000 members. Also, we've done outreach to other groups. Now there's 8 groups of us working together on this air pollution problem in Portland, representing about 10,000 Oregonians that we're in contact with either through Facebook, email, or through the United States Postal Service, explaining to people these issues that we're researching. One of the big concerns has been bullseye glass, 7,000 pounds of heavy metals being put into what is essentially an incinerator next to a daycare. One of the big concerns is that bullseye glass didn't have a filter, and that they're really emblematic of the kind of problem that we're having here in Portland. Honestly, I'm dismayed to hear about North Star Glass being hauled into this. It's not that I don't think that North Star Glass and other small glass manufacturers shouldn't have a filter on their stacks. However, what you're doing is you're singling out a glass manufacturer, a colored glass manufacturer, because it was in the news, because it was in the media. So what the DEQ is doing is they're jumping on the media bandwagon instead of focusing on the serious polluters of Portland. Now, certainly bullseye glass is one of those serious polluters, but instead of looking at North Star Glass, they should be looking at, Owens Rockway Glass that puts out 250 pounds of lead annually. Somehow they slip through the cracks. They should be looking at General Glass, which is almost as big as bullseye glass is somehow they're in a different category of glass, so they didn't get looked at. They should be looking at the tank farms, the re-refineries, the platers using hexavalent chromium, even though they could be using trivalent chromium. The problem they're having in Portland, is it the industry, we wonder, or is it the Department of Environmental Quality? When I started talking to government about this problem, I got lots of cooperation from the county government, from the federal government, who both assigned as workers. But for the Department of Environmental Quality, it's just been this fight. Every time I ask for information, they put up enormous fees, which we have to then look to lawsuits and the Environmental Quality Commission and our members and other groups to get the basic information that we want. We're the ones that broke the permit review from the from Bullseye Glass to the public. We fought the DEQ for a year. They gave us 5,000 pages after a big long fight. We scanned the whole thing and put this stuff on the web for the first time. I was angry and dismayed to look at that review from the Department of Environmental Quality, where they acknowledged that even if the glass company, even if General Glass, even if Bullseye Glass, they said, we're putting 24,000 pounds of lead, cadmium, arsenic, and chromium up their stacks, and none of it made it into the product. They still wouldn't regulate. So here now, we're talking about temporary rules, which I think are a good thing, to require these filters. However, because it's being media-driven instead of health-driven, or because of instead of it being a consistent public policy like it is in California, what's happening is all the other industries and their trucks are slipping through the cracks. So I would ask the DEQ to be more cooperative with the public, to be more transparent with the public, and to apply rules that are health-based to all industries, and not just the industries that make it to the front page. So right now we have 1,000 members, and I'm about to canvas every door in the Bullseye Glass area door-to-door. We're now moving into door-to-door work. And now that we've built these partnerships with these other groups, now we're escalating our campaign because we see so little change that basically Portlanders are upset and angry about this issue. When I talk to them, they read the stuff in the paper and they want to see change, and we see the change is inadequate. And so we're looking at permit fights with individual industries, the ones I mentioned and others. And it's unfortunate that we're being made as the regulator instead of.
Okay. My name is Chris Minnie. I'm owner and operator of Cavi Glass in Eugene, Oregon. I'm concerned about four elements in the proposed changes to OER 340, Division 244. Individually, they're relatively benign, but when considered together, they have the potential to increase the scope of these rules sufficiently that they could be applied to any art glass processing facility that uses furnaces or kiln to create art glasses, but specifically kiln work and offhand glass blowing, and potentially down to the level of the small hobby kiln worker or glass blower. If this came about, it would have a drastic negative impact on the glass art in the state of Oregon. Further, if these rules are copied by other states or on the national level, a distinct possibility, this could seriously harm the glass art in the United States. I don't believe this is the intention of the Oregon DEQ, and I would respectfully ask that these items be examined in this light for possible refinements so as to better define the target facilities and processes. These items are, one, lack of a specific definition for the term melt and the use of the phrase molten glass for the purpose of enforcing this rule. The current definition of a glass-making furnace is so broad that it effectively includes the kilns, glory holes, and small crucible kilns used in nearly all glass-working studios. Three, the current definition of any colored glass as a raw material. And four, the Fiscal Advisory Committee is on record as suggesting that the trigger level be lowered from the current 10 tons yearly to as little as 1 pound. specifically, item one, lack of definition for the term melt and the use of the term molten glass. Glasses are solids with a unique property. Above a certain temperature, they have the ability to move and flow while still in solid form. To those unfamiliar with this phenomenon, they appear to be in a liquid state. This leads to a lot of confusion centered around the term melt in the glass art and elsewhere, to the point where it is fair to consider melt an abused term. The phrase molten glass is an oxymoron. Once glass melts, it's not a glass anymore. It's a liquid. The process of making glass is this. You mix up a batch from a recipe, heat it up until it has fully liquefied, then cool it slightly and wait for the glass matrix to drop out of the liquid precursor. If the glass maker gets the glass maker got the recipe right, there will be no liquid component in a fully mature glass batch. So people in here can comment. This is important during this rulemaking for two reasons. First, during the melting process and while the batch is fully liquid is when most and possibly all of the heavy metals escape to become halves. They either get carried out along with the outgassing of raw batch materials as part of the exhaust stream in an air fuel furnace or boil out of liquid milk. It's the process of making this melt that needs to be regulated. Once the glass matrix forms, the remaining metals are trapped and can't go anywhere. The second reason is that confusion about melt. This rulemaking is about limiting or eliminating halves in the process of making new glasses. Processes that then use these glass to make art products, kilnwork, lampworking, and glassblowing, don't emit halves, and it should be made clear that they do not fall within the scope of these rules. This becomes especially important if the trigger weight is reduced. If the trigger levels are lowered enough, potentially all kilnwork and glassblowing could be regulated under this rule. Glass artists simply don't have the ability to keep up with the regulatory requirements in terms of testing and documentation. It would put them all out of business. It's my understanding that the DEQ has no desire or need to regulate this activity. Let's specifically write it out of these rules. If this is not true and the DEQ staff has found evidence that these processes do indeed emit heavy metals as halves, please make this information publicly available so that kiln workers and glassblowers can adequately protect themselves and the people around them. None of us wants to poison anybody. My suggested solution for this first element is define melt as the process of bringing a mixture of raw materials, possibly including glasses, to a fully liquid state for the purpose of creating new glass, and remove molten glass from the text to avoid ambiguity. Item two, the definition of a glass-making furnace as a refractory lined vessel in which raw materials are charged and melted at a high temperature to produce molten glass. Given the lack of a definition for melt and the use of the oxymoron molten glass, a refractory lined vessel in which raw materials are charged and melted at high temperatures to produce molten glass describes nearly every heat source used in most working studios. Kilns, glory holes, and small crucible kilns all fit this definition. This equipment is not used for making glass, but serves to reheat glass materials that they are transformed into their final form. None of these devices produce halves. Without better definition of the glass-making processes you're trying to regulate, someone unfamiliar with the technical intricacies of the glass art could decide that these devices and activities fall within the scope of these rules. Again, lowering the trigger weight has a huge effect, potentially including every kiln down to the hobby level. The solution to this, I feel, is change the definition to read a refractory lined vessel in which raw materials are charged and brought to a fully liquid state for the purpose of making new glass. Vessels used solely for reheating glasses are not considered furnaces for the purposes of this rule. Item three, definition of any colored glass as a raw material. The purpose of this rulemaking is to prevent the emission of halves during the glassmaking process. While heavy metals are present in colored glasses, they are locked into the glass matrix and generally cannot interact with the outside world. This lock is so effective that inclusion in borosilicate glasses is considered the method of choice for sequestration of high-level nuclear waste, the most toxic substance known to man. Heavy metal colorants in glasses can generally only be emitted as halves under certain circumstances. One, when mixed with non-colored raw materials that tend to outgas as part of the glass forming process, the metals can be carried away with the expressed gases. And two, when used in a batch that is then brought to a full melt using an air fuel heat source, the metals can be carried away with the exhaust stream. Mixtures containing only glasses or only glasses and raw colorants that do not outgas and that are heated in electric furnaces will not produce heavy metal halves. These mixtures should not fall within the scope of these rules. I'm also concerned that unilaterally defining all colored glasses as raw materials in all circumstances creates a circular definition where any combination of glasses that includes a colored glass becomes a mixture of colored and raw materials, one of the included definitions of a raw glass batch. Given the overly broad definition of a glass-making furnace and that melt is not properly defined, a sufficiently enthusiastic enforcement could apply these rules to the use of any colored glass in heat sufficient to allow the glass to flow, such as a fusing kiln or on a glass blowing bench. Possible solutions are eliminate the circular definition by removing colored glasses as a raw material, or only consider colored glasses to be a raw material when they are mixed in with non-colored raw materials that will outgas or brought to a fully liquid state in an air fuel fired furnace. Item 4, suggestion by the advisory committee that the trigger level be lowered to as little as 1 pound. I can't honestly see how this will benefit anyone other than the existing manufacturers that are suggesting it. I've discussed above how lowering these trigger levels could inappropriately widen the scope of these rules. If there's a need to regulate other glassworking processes, this should be addressed as a separate rulemaking process with its own public discussion rather than some future expansion of this one. I will add some salient points. None of the five existing colored art glass manufacturers would have been able to start up and thrive if this had been in place when they started. I'm specifically talking about the trigger levels of 1 pound or around. Putting it in place now will just serve to nip this industry in the bud by preventing any new colored art glass manufacturers from starting up. The art glass was until recently a vital, growing, and thriving industry in Oregon. We all fervently hope we can eventually get back to that position. It's also important to note that with the closure of Spectrum Glass in Washington, this industry is almost entirely located in Oregon. In my opinion, the economic arguments put forward higher costs will encourage bootleg glass makers is moot. These manufacturers' prices are already well past the point of screwing this if it was going to happen. In all honesty, this industry would benefit from some healthy competition to drive prices down, as they have in Europe. Further, it's important to remember that these customers are artists and glassblowers. Very few of them have the technical skills and discipline or the desire to go there. Instead, they view this as an unwanted digression from doing what they love. How many bakers really want to grind their own flour? Last, on the possibility of expanding this statewide, I'm of two minds. On the one hand, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Of all the many artists and glassworkers I've talked with since this controversy began, not one has expressed any desire to have no controls over air quality in place, or that this rulemaking is somehow unneeded. None of us wants to poison our neighbors. However, we are all very dismayed at the rush to implement and the extreme economic hardship this has caused for many artists and glassblowers. Why were no materials users included in the advisory committee? On the other hand, I can see some real value in creating an incentive for colored art glass manufacturers to relocate or start up outside Oregon's most densely populated area. Currently, there are no Oregon-based colored art glass manufacturers outside the Portland area. Spreading this industry out could have real economic benefits by encouraging growth. Let's not forget that this industry is unique. We are doing things here in Oregon that is not done anywhere else. It's part of what makes us who we are, and the whole world is better for us. Thank you for your consideration.
Catherine Salton.
Hi, I'm Catherine Salton. I've lived in the Bullseye Glass neighborhood for over 30 years, and I'm also a founding member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition. However, I'm not representing them tonight. They are currently working on formulating a very specific document. I'm just here as myself, and as somebody who's been paying a lot of attention to this from the very beginning. The first thing I want to do is submit the Craig Law Center's document, which I'm sure is already in your files. This is when the temporary rule first came. This was their comment on the temporary rule. I want you to have this. They also wrote temporary rules. that they thought were more protective of human health than the ones that written by the DEQ, and I couldn't find a copy of that for you, but they should be in your file. You have them. They were submitted to you back in March. And I'm actually going to write something and submit it online that's a lot more comprehensive, but I just wanted to highlight a couple of things. And that is that I really think that the temporary rules should apply to all the heavy metals that are used by glass manufacturers, and that includes selenium and manganese, both of those that I'm not familiar with, but I know that we had a problem with selenium spiking in our neighborhood because it was not controlled by the rules or by any kind of agreement with I also think that the short-term and long-term benchmarks for emissions need to be reevaluated and set at the most protective human health level that you can find. I know that you did some research for the rules, and some of the levels that were chosen were not the most protective choices. I would like that to change. I just want to say there is simply no reason to continue to allow uncontrolled and unregulated emissions of hazardous air pollutants of any kind from both stationary and mobile industrial sources to continue in this day and age. Thank you very much, and thank you all very much. Have a
good day. Thank you. All right. So those are all the comments she's got so far. Does anyone else want to make a comment or to make a new comment? Anybody?
Do you have anybody on the phone?
Question.
All participants are now in interactive talk mode.
If there's anyone on the phone, is there someone who wants to submit a public comment for the rulemaking? Okay. I think maybe we don't have any comments coming in from the phone. Let's see. Do anyone have something else they want to say before I close the hearing? Yeah, thank you all for being here. I really appreciate the comments you brought tonight and also the questions and the Q&A. Your comments you gave verbally will be summarized and including just as soon as the written ones, so you're welcome to also submit written comments, and we'll get all the details if you do that. Good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Can we do good? You got the police waiting.